Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm really pleased and honored to welcome back into our studios Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business, Director of the A.W. Clawson Center for World Business, author of After the Cold War. And Professor Sear, of course, joins us on a monthly basis to talk about all kinds of different issues and topics that are of interest both here and abroad. And just as it sort of worked out, it isn't until the very end of June, nearly the very, very end of June, that Professor Sear is joining us. In some ways, it's propitious because had he joined us earlier in the month, we wouldn't be here talking about the dramatic events of the last few days. Needless to say, at the top of the list, the dramatic vote of the British public for Britain to leave the European Union. And of course, there are ramifications beyond the plunging stock market and other immediate signs. There are far-reaching consequences that we also need to talk about as well. And there's a lot beyond that to be discussing. So, Professor Art Sear, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you very much for having me back, Professor Berg.
Good to have you here. Good to have
Good
you here.
Good to be here. Okay, that's out of the way.
So let's talk about this vote and the fact that, first of all, everybody familiar with what was going on expected it to be a close vote, but most people predicted it was actually going to slip in the other way.
Yeah.
Narrowly, the British public would vote to remain with the European Union. Of course, it didn't go that way at all.
Yeah.
First of all, can you give us a little background on why this vote was taken at all? And whose decision, as far as you understand it, whose decision was it for this to be put to a vote before the British public? Did anything in particular prompt this vote in the first place?
It was the Prime Minister and the Parliament. The European Union and Europe historically has been and remains controversial, and the British people are divided about how much they want to be involved in Europe, and that dates back to Henry VIII and even further past in the foggy mists of history. To answer your question, Prime Minister Cameron initially presided over a coalition government for the first time since World War II. It's unusual in British politics, of his Conservative Party and the Liberal Democrats. The Conservatives have a very powerful anti-European, anti-EU faction, and he, in order to get along and help strengthen his position with this difficult population, he made a commitment to a referendum. Informed people think that he probably felt he wouldn't have to follow up on that because the coalition government was in place and there was no likelihood early on that the Conservatives would establish a majority on their own, which they did barely in the 2015 election. I think politics pressed him to do that. I think he's got integrity and he wanted to follow through. He'd given his word, and Parliament approved the idea of a referendum.
So talk for a moment about this long view situation in terms of Britain being and yet not quite being a part of Europe. Is that mostly just due to sort of the geographical separation of Great Britain from the continent of Europe itself, or are there other factors at play that have created this situation and this sense of partnership yet tension over all these centuries?
Well, that's a big question and not easily answered, and I'll try to be brief, especially for me. The ethnic population, the cultural history of the British Isles is different from the continent. They established the rule of common law quite early on when the monarch was still very much dominant and in charge. But the idea of representation of the people can be dated back to the Magna Carta, not the people at large, but those local barons who and leaders by force who controlled land and paid taxes to the crown insisted that they have representation for that taxation. I think that, which from my point of view directly evolved into the common law system, really differentiates Britain from the continent. The British are the original practitioners since ancient times, at least, and in a secular, political, national sense of balance of power politics. Henry VIII, the great leader, rather unpleasant leader, but nonetheless great leader in establishing modern Britain, had a portrait of himself painted at one point back in the 1500s where he was holding scales, and which symbolized, I believe, Spain and France, whom, with in Latin on the painting, whomever I support will prevail. I've seen firsthand a very attractive painting in a big country home in Oxfordshire near Oxford University that's used for Ditchley Park, which is used for conferences that bring together the mostly the British and the Americans since the 1950s. A wonderful portrait of Queen Elizabeth the First, not the current Elizabeth, holding, I think, a scepter, standing on the British Isles, but with one foot cautiously placed on the coast of France.
Wow.
And it's a great painting, but it also symbolizes this approach of separation.
Right, and this sort of uneasy situation. As we, as the campaign, as it were, unfolded, what's your understanding of what was sort of driving the anti-EU forces in Britain the most? I mean, what was sort of the rallying cry in terms of encouraging British citizens to vote to leave the EU? What were the biggest reasons trumpeted for doing that?
Insofar as you can be specific, hostility to immigration, a feeling that Britain has been disadvantaged, a feeling, not facts, but a feeling that Britain has been disadvantaged by involvement with Brussels, the administrative head of the capital of the European Union, and more kind of animistic hostility that's historically rooted, which is why I brought up the far past. I think those are the main reasons. In Britain, as in other industrial nations, there is a lot of turmoil connected with very rapid pace of industrial and employment change. Now, if you look at the facts, people are out of work not because their job, a man or woman's job, has been picked up and taken to China or some other low-wage third-world country. That doesn't happen to be true. Automation, and especially the transportation as well as production revolutions, that's why jobs are, in fact, disappearing. But people don't believe that. What people believe is that my jobs are being taken away from me. Now, I can talk pompously here because I have a job. If you're unemployed, a lot of our listeners, though not all of them, know what it's like to be without income. I've been fortunate to stay steadily employed from a young age, but I know what it's like from time to time to be out of work, certainly not lately. Europe had a particularly hard time during the Great Depression, and there are older people and younger people who didn't experience that directly, but their parents and grandparents did, and for working people, that's a vivid memory. So these emotional appeals are really attractive and not to be minimized by us cerebral types who talk on and listen to public radio.
So you, like many people, predicted that the vote would go the other way. I think you said it was going to, I'm sure you said it was going to be close, but it was your sense and the sense of just about everybody who rendered an opinion on that, that this vote was going to go the other direction.
If I may correct you, sir, since we're on the air, yeah, I thought they'd vote to stay in, frankly, but in anticipation of confronting you, I reread my column on the subject, and I hedged my bets.
Ah.
I tried to give a balanced analysis of the different factors involved, and then I put at the bottom London bookmakers, the odds were heavily in favor of remaining in Britain.
Right.
And then they started to go the other way, but I put the onus on them. I protected myself.
Good idea.
Okay, buddy, that's what you always do. You cover yourself.
Right,
okay?
Right.
Yeah.
So was there sophisticated polling going on? I mean, did anybody have any, in a sense, scientific basis to predict how this was going to go? I don't remember seeing, in a sense, poll numbers or survey numbers, or was it more just kind of an informal feeling or sense that a lot of people had about the way this was going to go?
No, it was both. And polling is very scientific nowadays compared to decades ago. I think public opinion was very fluid. There is some criticism of British polling organizations for being, they have been off on at least one general election fairly recently, and there is criticism of them for not being as accurate as, say, polls in the U.S. I honestly don't know if that's true or not. But bookmakers are not to be underestimated. There was a famous gambler and gangster by the name of Lefty Rosenthal in this country who died fairly recently. He was a very effective operator in a pretty violent world, a basically honest man. He was a mathematical genius and wizard. The film Casino is with Robert De Niro as base. It's a Hollywood hype version of his life, but in many ways it's accurate. And he was extremely scientific. He made very large amounts of money for himself and partners throughout his life, and he was in demand by law enforcement as well as the business world to provide quantitative analysis based on facts but also on his feelings. I wasn't trying to be funny, and I wasn't really trying to pass the buck by mentioning London gamblers. It's a very good source of information. I think opinion was very, very fluid. It was very close. This was no huge majority, as you know, in favor of getting out of Europe. It was very close, which hands the politicians a big challenge.
Right. A couple of immediate consequences or ramifications of the vote. One of them was the decision of Prime Minister David Cameron to step down. Mm-hmm. And I believe his initial statement was that he would step down as of October 1st. And now I understand that his party is actually putting together kind of a plan for a successor, which could see him stepping down even a little earlier than that.
Yeah.
Were you surprised by that move that he made? And do you understand why he made that decision? I mean, it's obviously something he didn't absolutely have to do. Why did he do that, as far as you know?
Well, he did that because he felt it was the right thing to do. Also, there's a lot of pressure on a prime minister when things go drastically wrong to resign. And he could have hung on. There are leaders in Britain who have. I admire him greatly. I think the biggest loss from this referendum is we're losing him as a highly intelligent, extremely hardworking, and very effective political leader who happens to be the head of the government until October, according to current plan, of our closest ally. Now, like in the past, the British have been a great positive influence on us. In 1963, Harold Macmillan, another great leader in my opinion, another conservative leader, resigned when the defense minister, Profumo, got in very serious trouble. Now, what the newspapers advertised was his involvement with a prostitute who was also involved at the same time with an aide and an intelligence officer with the Soviet embassy in London. That was the headlines, but Profumo had lied to the House, which is unacceptable in their system, and Macmillan felt he had to step down. Neville Chamberlain, after the fall of France in 1940, in a terribly dangerous and threatening time for everybody, not just them, he was destroyed by the outbreak of World War II and the fall of France. It would have been hard. He experienced, I believe, directly a vote of no confidence, unlike these other two examples. But he felt compelled to step down.
Right.
So Winston Churchill's compassionate side was shown by the way he treated Chamberlain as he treated others after that, and Chamberlain's widow after Chamberlain died. It's a good system, I think, in terms of facing harsh reality. But also a kind of collegiality that we can learn from.
Right. So, in a sense, Prime Minister Cameron treated this vote on the European Union, in a sense, almost as a de facto no-confidence vote, even though that's not...
That's well put, yeah.
But that's literally not what this was. This wasn't literally that, but
no,
in a sense, he interpreted it as that.
That's very well put. Actually, that's an extremely good good point. I should be asking you questions. It shows he's what Lefty Rosenthal would refer to as a class act. It was a very classy move by an extremely ambitious politician to do that. And he also forces everybody else to face the fact, look at what you've done. Now let's start focusing in on how to deal with this.
Right. I guess what really surprised me about that move is that I would have understood it maybe more if it had been a more decisive vote. But the fact that it was so incredibly close, it was certainly a disappointment for him, but I wouldn't have interpreted that vote as some sort of personal repudiation of him and all he stands for. So I, for one, was surprised by that move, but I guess I understand it. And in some ways, he's handing off what could be a very messy situation to somebody else to deal with.
Yeah, but he'll remain in the party. He's not going to withdraw from politics. And again, I'm a great admirer of his. I think his predecessor, the Labour Prime Minister, Tony Blair, was overall extremely successful and positive, even though he's become a pariah in Britain thanks to their intense reaction against the Iraq War and his, I believe, in the British context, very courageous decision to support President G.W. Bush and the administration in our invasion and attack on Iraq. There are lots of reasons why Blair as well, I think, has been a positive example as prime minister. He hasn't behaved all that well since he left, from my point of view.
Right. So the withdrawal of Britain from the European Union, let's talk a moment about beyond the nasty way in which world markets reacted. What actually does this, in fact, cause to happen? What's going to happen to Britain, and what's going to happen to the European Union in light of this move? And, of course, in a sense, that departure hasn't even happened yet. I don't even remember the timetable that we're talking about before Britain, in fact, exits the EU.
There is no formal timetable, and today I believe Prime Minister Cameron will be meeting with his counterparts in Europe, and they'll be discussing these matters. Some continental politicians and senior bureaucrats have talked, I think, inappropriately, as we say nowadays, short-sightedly, about, well, they want to leave. Let's get them out as quickly as possible. That would not be wise. I think both Britain and Brussels will have to face reality, and especially because the British are involved, I think they'll work things out pragmatically. Since World War II, Britain's trade has moved very, very dramatically and heavily into the continent, with the economic fading of the old British Empire and the still extant and rather important British Commonwealth, but their trade has moved into Europe. At the same time, external barriers to the market, originally they set up very high protective walls, the original six members of the EEC in 57, and Washington quite wisely supported this. It was a very wise move on our part strategically. Those barriers, especially given the fluidity of capital today, we focus on labor, but capital is extremely fluid. At the same time that Britain was finally, they were, after being humiliated twice by Charles de Gaulle, the leader of France in 63 and 67, they came in 73. In 1973, coincidentally, commercial banks, the really big guys that are the focus of fire today, Citibank in those days, Chase Manhattan Bank, banks and industrial nations around the world, including Japan, for the first time put in place an electronic telephonic network so that they could do financial transactions almost instantly. That has evolved into the global financial network that we all pay attention to today. That means that traditional protectionist barriers are a good deal less important. There are also political structures in place that we can talk about if you wish that will facilitate Britain. That will facilitate Britain remaining. Remaining in Europe, I believe.
So talk for a moment about Britain's significance on the world economic stage? Because I think for some people, this is a little bit of a surprise. The fact that, you know, when you look on a map, Britain is not this looming presence geographically. And, of course, you've already touched on how they no longer possess the empire that they once did. So they do not reach across the globe the way that they once did in terms of their empire. And yet, Britain is a very significant player on the world's economic stages. Explain, and maybe even to some extent kind of quantify, that significance. I mean, why does Britain matter to the rest of the world to the extent that this move out of the European Union sent shockwaves, you know, really across the planet? What is their significance?
London, along with Frankfurt, Zurich, New York, of course, and Tokyo, is a principal financial marketplace in the world, not only for stocks and bonds and related financial instruments, but for insurance, which in many ways is where an international financial market first began, with salvaging of ships and insurance guarantees of rather risky overseas financial investments, going back literally hundreds of years. When the euro came in, Britain is in the common market, but they did not join the common currency at the turn of the century, quite wisely in my view, but also at that point they were not financially strong enough to securely join a uniform currency. And that was clear as early as the early 90s. There were a lot of predictions when the euro was put in place that Frankfurt, Zurich, Frankfurt, Paris would replace London. That hasn't happened. Therefore, given the financial importance of London, which I believe will continue and probably grow in the future, but I'm not Lefty Rosenthal, okay? As you pointed out, my predictions aren't always on the money. Role of London will continue, and that means any great change in the structure of their relationships with Europe is really important. The military significance of Britain is very, very important. There are very practical reasons having to do with using armed force effectively, not just using armed force, that the British built this empire and pretty much ran the world for about 200 years. In hindsight, they didn't do so badly in a very different, undemocratic time. They still have, I think, the second largest surface ship navy in the world after the United States, and I assure you they have a very, very impressive record of effectiveness in military affairs. Therefore, their security involvement, the special relationship with the U.S., which is real, and also their involvement in NATO, which continues, binds the North Atlantic together. I believe that will grow in importance in the future.
That is NATO, you mean?
NATO, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. The Europeans toy with the idea of having a military and security dimension. It's fairly meaningless. It satisfies political egos and especially senior administrators' ambitions, not just in Brussels. But nation states are very jealous of their military forces. There is no European military force. There's no UN military force. You get military forces because a nation state has agreed to second them or loan them to some larger entity.
Mm. So there's been a lot of talk about how Britain will ultimately be hurt by this, this was a short-sighted decision, if we want to call it that, made by collectively by the British people, and also that the European Union will be hurt by Britain's withdrawal. Let's talk about the first thing first. Potentially, at least, how could Britain be hurt by leaving the European Union?
The argument runs, companies will leave Britain because Britain's relatively open economy has facilitated investment not only in Britain, but also investment in trade throughout Europe. The Japanese became very heavy investors in Britain, very important, in the 80s, because they had access to the rest of Europe for a time, at least. France especially went to great lengths to keep Japanese products, especially automobiles, out of Europe. There was one customs depot in France near the coast, notoriously, as far as the eye could see, you could see Japanese automobiles, you know, piled up.
Wow.
Like
impounded,
sardines,
you mean?
Waiting to be cleared by customs, by a couple of 70 or 80-year-old customs agents. I exaggerate, but that was the practice.
Wow.
And the British have never been that way, despite the terrible and bitter war with Japan in the 40s. The British economy was more open. Companies that are locating in Britain or thinking about locating in Britain, the argument goes, we'll go to the continent. I think those are exaggerated. Britain is the fifth largest economy in the world. I already mentioned the financial importance of London. Europe and Britain have an interest in continuing to collaborate, and external barriers are not nearly as consequential as they used to be.
So their withdrawal from the European Union, in fact, might not be as detrimental to the health of Britain's economy as maybe is feared, maybe as it would have been a few years ago.
Well, I'm sure that, yes, and referring to the past is important here. They had an earlier referendum on the European Economic Community, the Labour government, in 1975 under Harold Wilson, soon to be succeeded by James Callaghan. The Tories, conservatives, were in power. Surprisingly, they won in 1970. The polls were way off then. There were two rather indecisive elections in 74, and after the second in October, Harold Wilson, very successful long-term political operative and prime minister in the Labour Party, was able to get a majority. They had, again, for political reasons, a referendum to try to solidify commitment to Europe, and Wilson, shrewd operator that he was, got a two-thirds majority, even though then the Labour Party, not the Conservatives, the Labour Party was the anti-Europe party. In 75, in the 70s, through much of the 60s, Britain was regarded as the sick man, I beg your pardon, sick person of Europe, this weak, wheezing economy, economically, effectively destroyed by the Second World War, along with the terrible human losses, going through the great strain of giving up this great global empire, which they did very smoothly, but they were seen as a very weak economy. Economic deregulation, which Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher pushed, but also reflecting wider trends. The great growth of globalization, as we call it now, really benefited Britain. So they're now one of the strongest and most effective economies in Europe. They're not muscle-bound with bureaucracy like the continent, including Germany. So they're in a very good position to benefit from future developments. They also put in place a structure. I'm kind of getting long-winded as usual, but this really is a complicated subject. The European Free Trade Organization, they could have joined the Treaty of Rome along with West Germany, France, Italy, Belgium, the Netherlands, and Luxembourg in 57. They chose not to do so. They set up a competitive organization, the European Free Trade Association, the geographically peripheral countries, balance of power, not used effectively this time. The EFTA amounted to nothing over time. It did not in any way balance what is now the EU. However, it's still around. There are kind of four surviving members. Norway, much discussed today because of their very positive non-member relationship with the EU, Switzerland, Iceland, and Liechtenstein. It's been suggested that Britain might well try to use a renewed link-up with the EFTA as a way of maintaining access to the EU. This is a fluid situation.
Interesting.
And a promising one for British pragmatism. The Wall Street Journal has suggested that Britain might join NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, which I think is very imaginative, would require sustained executive leadership by whoever happens to be in the White House. But that's a real possibility and something at least to use as leverage with Europe.
interesting.
It is interesting. These are more interesting than non-business people, non-economists often think. These are really interesting subjects.
Right, and could have far-reaching consequences.
Absolutely, including for us.
Right. Something else I heard on NPR and also read in a couple of different places is some fears, although not everybody, you know, fears this possibility or dreads this possibility, and other people do, the possibility of the United Kingdom perhaps breaking up over this. That is, Ireland and Northern Ireland and Scotland and so on, that would all kind of come apart from England, potentially. Yeah. I'm not sure I even yet fully understand just how these events are linked. But do you see that as a possibility and also as something that would be significant if it were
yes.
to occur?
Yes. Yes to both. Scotland voted very heavily to stay within Europe, as did Northern Ireland. Gibraltar, we talked about military strategy. Gibraltar, the vital fortress that guards literally the entrance and exit from the Mediterranean. They're all very pro-Europe. One of the most impressive British political leaders to me, after Prime Minister Cameron, is Nicola Sturgeon, the longtime leader of the Scottish National Party. In the last general election, they wiped out Labour. Scotland is an historic bastion for Labour, not anymore. The SNP swept parliamentary seats. They have a strong delegation in Parliament. She's already making moves to protect their regional interest, and they're at least talking about possibly negotiating a separate agreement with the EU.
Wow.
A referendum about a year and a half ago on Scottish independence failed just barely. Again, reflecting the complicated environment in which Cameron and co. have to operate in Britain. But she's pressing very forcefully, and she's a very skillful politician, for another referendum very soon. Northern Ireland, that gets a lot of media attention. Northern Ireland does not, but it should. That's the Protestant bastion at the northern tip of Catholic Ireland. Starting 1969-70, a renewed IRA, Irish Republican Army, became very violent and, in effect, renewed civil war in Northern Ireland. My son David and I went to London not long after he graduated from high school to celebrate this milestone. In the early 90s, we stayed at the Carlton Club in London. I'm glad we were able to do so. These places are fascinating to stay and educational in themselves. The day after we left, the IRA bombed the Carlton Club.
Wow.
So it brought home to us just how significant this is. The British are never to be underestimated in terms of military and intelligence success, working closely and quite secretly, for the most part, with the loyalists in Northern Ireland. They killed, literally, the IRA extremists. They wiped them out. They also brokered an agreement with Ireland that opened the borders in 98. British success, working with the Unionists, but it was really British leadership, ended this threat by the end of the 90s. A small but bitter and ugly war.
Mm-hmm.
All wars are that, but this was really a nasty one, a dirty war, which the British excel at combating. The 98 agreement opened the borders between the North and the South. There is a vexing and potentially very dangerous flashpoint in Northern Ireland now. Ireland is a good member of the EU. This referendum greatly complicates life for London in dealing with Ireland and with Ulster.
Mm. So time will tell.
It's a real challenge.
Wow.
As is Gibraltar, which also has close ties with Spain. So
right.
There's no shortage of things to keep serious people busy, and demagogues like Nigel Farage, this very unpleasant and I think irresponsible leader of the UK Independence Party, in the news. But for serious people, which he is not, this is a challenging time.
Yeah. And then what about the potential harm to the European Union? To what extent is the EU itself harmed or undermined by Britain's withdrawal?
I think it forces them to face reality that they are not an emerging United States of Europe, that they have to pay attention to public opinion. In 2005, Brussels pushed very hard for a European constitution, which was worthy of a third world country. It went on, unlike our brief and very clear American constitution, it went on and on and on with all kinds of complexities and reflecting all kinds of meetings among articulate bureaucrats who don't have to face the people at election time. Other countries rejected it, but the British spearheaded the move in 2005 to reject it quite wisely. Brussels is going to have to be more pragmatic, more realistic, deal with the masses, so to speak, if they're going to continue to maintain an EU. One other important point that isn't much mentioned in the news, I did some research, seat of the pants variety yesterday, preparing to get on the air with you. In terms of U.S. exports to Britain, to a remarkable degree, there are vehicles, not just automobiles, and machinery. Not all high-tech computer type machines and gadgets that are in the news today, but heavy industrial machinery, heavily automated. These literally heavy trade trends are not going to change just because Britain voted against being in Europe. To me, it symbolizes the British role as a bridge between EU and trade with the rest of the world. And things move very rapidly nowadays in every economic dimension, but these are manufacturing markets that are not going to change quickly.
Mm-hmm. Well, we are going to certainly watch with great interest what proceeds from here. And, of course,
yeah,
we'll
absolutely.
Also, among other things, continue to watch the markets. The hope is that that the volatility that, of course, was so very serious on Friday, not quite so volatile yesterday, will continue to calm down and cooler heads will prevail in more ways than one as events move ahead. We'll go from cooler heads prevailing to the current presidential race here in America. We don't have a whole lot of time to talk about this, but it certainly has been a fascinating race the way it has. The way it has rolled out. Of course, one of the most significant events in the last week or two has been a bit of a shakeup in the Donald Trump campaign with the dismissal of his campaign manager.
Lewandowski.
Right. And who's now been hired as an analyst for CNN or commentator for CNN. But that sort of prompted some discussion that helped me understand how Donald Trump has really run a campaign very different from the standard. For one thing, in terms of its size, in terms of the number of people working for him and sort of the network that typically is necessary, that just hasn't been there. And it's just so not only is he himself, in terms of what he says and how he says it, a very unconventional candidate, but also in sort of that nuts and bolts way in terms of how his campaign has functioned, I didn't even realize how different that has been from the norm. Is this the new way that this is going to be done, do you think, in the future, or is he an anomaly?
Well, I certainly hope he's an anomaly, and I think he is. The campaign slogan might well be there's one born every minute, because he's not raising or spending that much money. Very detailed information in the serious press indicates the money's being spent on vendors which he happens to own. So it's as usual with him, it's a way of making money off of other people. I had the very challenging and very educational experience of running the World Trade Center Association in Chicago for 2 years before I came to Carthage. I got hired because they were in some serious trouble, and I'm very proud of the fact that working with the chairman who recruited me, Neil Hardigan, and very fine people on the staff, that we got the place out of trouble, solved some IRS problems, and had a lot of money in the bank when I very happily moved on after the end of the second year that I'd contracted for. We raised money from Gary, Indiana, which had Donald Trump was one of the impresarios who sold them on gambling. They were opening gambling casinos. They had a fair amount of cash. And if you're in trouble, I mean, you should look for a client who's in more serious trouble than you are. Gary was recognized as the murder capital of the world at the time in the media. The mayor, Scott King, his predecessor, had made the commitment to gambling casinos, was casting about for serious investment. Gambling, like drinking, is a distraction. It doesn't really solve your problems. They had a lot of cash, and we were able to sign a contract, which was crucial in meeting our payroll. And I was able to get it renewed not long before I left, meeting our payroll initially. I never had any trouble in Gary, parts of which looked like Berlin in the spring of 1945. I mean, just blasted buildings, huge potholes like bomb craters. I was treated with great respect at one fundraiser I went to on a Saturday night in an amphitheater, because I was one of a small handful of white people in addition to the mayor who was there. I spoke at the Chamber of Commerce once, which met on a gambling boat, not Trump's, but one of the others. He wasn't really fully installed there yet. And seeing it was a bad place to meet from my point of view, I very much valued this partnership with the people going into these casinos. It wasn't the kind you see in the ads. Very poor people, mostly white, people without any money are the people who are lured into these kind of nests. And it really personified to me just how potentially dangerous gambling is. It's not a harmless vice, but just how crude and crummy Trump is, frankly. He's not a businessman. He's a leech.
Well, the fact that so much of what he has done has been based in that industry, you mean?
Well, look at literally everything he's done. There are hotels that are classy that people go to, but he's someone who failed twice tremendously in business because it's not really business. It's not really commerce. It's a con game at a gigantic level. A man who inherited a great deal of money and blew it all and a huge fortune in debt, in addition, is now being considered for the presidency of the United States, something we all ought to reflect on.
One of the things that I've heard when it comes to the Republican Party trying to come to terms with its identity and with him as their candidate is the fact that sometimes when you stir up anger amongst the populace, that's a force that sometimes you cannot control, that you can't reason with, can't forge compromises with, and sometimes you end up in a situation that you never anticipated.
Yes, quite right. That's a very good point. It's analogous to what we've been talking about regarding Brussels bureaucrats. The most important responsibility of the presidency of the president of the United States is the use of military force, including nuclear force, where there is independent authority to the president and the office of the chief executive. The election is simple for me. I happen to be watching the Republican debate when Trump viciously and in a morally filthy way slandered John McCain, who probably would not be a very good president in my view, but as a truly heroic war hero who should be only honored by our country. This man who avoided military service slandered him. None of the Republican candidates on that stage with him called him on this despicable statement. Mitch McConnell, the Republican Senate leader, mumbled something a day or two later. That greatly simplified the election for me. There's no way I could vote for somebody like that, speaking quite personally, but I don't think this is just my personality talking.
Well, it will be interesting to see, of course, one of the possibilities with the dismissal of his campaign manager. I read a really interesting article about the Trump campaign in New York Times magazine, which said that this Mr. Lewandowski, he believed that an uncensored Trump that's what people were responding to. So he resisted all advice to try to tame him down and make him sound more presidential. He didn't think that was the right thing to do at all. And with his departure, some people are predicting that Mr. Trump is going to perhaps attempt to sound more presidential, to speak in more terms of policy and so on. Do you see much potential there?
I think he could well be elected president of the United States, especially if former Secretary Hillary Clinton is indicted by the federal government.
Are you seeing that as a very real possibility?
I don't know. I think it's significant that the FBI investigation is going on so long. The State Department Inspector General has already issued a report. FBI Director Comey is seen as a truly straight arrow and a very honest man who's dedicated to doing the right thing. I assure you I have no inside information. In this case, I don't want any. I don't know what's going to happen. All I'm saying is that could be a major, major problem and an opportunity for Trump if it happens.
Interesting. Well, we'll be watching,
yeah,
of course.
All too interesting, isn't it? Yeah,
right. We'll be watching both of those conventions with great interest. Any thoughts on what the Democrats in the House of Representatives did with their sit-in demonstration a few days ago?
Well, Speaker Ryan denounced it as a stunt, and a political cartoon in the Kenosha News caricatured him, as cartoons are supposed to do, and said this is a stunt, unlike the 60-some votes that the Republicans have had in the House on what they term Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. In other words, both parties do stunts. This is particularly dramatic. I think it shows how understandably deeply felt feelings are on gun violence and gun control. I think, especially given the state of the executive branch currently and likely in the future, legislative leadership is really important in both parties. And if the Republicans keep their majority, Speaker Ryan's role will be very, very important. If the Democrats come back and Nancy Pelosi comes back as Speaker, her role will be very, very important. I think one prediction I will make is however the election turns out, I think we'll be probably entering a time when legislative leadership of the executive branch continues to grow.
Mm. Well, in these interesting times in which we live, it's always good to have you here to talk us through it. Professor Art Sear from the Clausen Center at Carthage College, thank you for being here today on The Morning Show.
Well, thank you, Greg. I much appreciate it.
Good to have you here. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, a couple of different interviews, including one with Mark Eichner, who directs the Racine Municipal